You're listening to Crosspoint Community Church in LaGrange, Texas podcast. To learn more about Crosspoint Community Church, including service times and how you can connect, please visit crosspointchurchtx.org.
We are wrapping up our series, Let's Talk About It. And I'm thinking about questions. And so this week we're really dealing with some questions, some what I would call cleanup questions that people ask based upon several of the messages. And so if you don't remember, over the last few weeks, we talked about worry, we talked about anger, we talked about addictions, we talked about trauma, we talked about grief and depression and different levels. And one of the things is that, in all honesty, is it wasn't enough time. We just kind of basically touched on the surface, allowed you to begin to think about that I'm normal. If I have any of these things in my life, this is normalcy. And to remove, hopefully, some of the stigma, some of the burdens that sometimes we carry as Christians, that we've been in Christ, that we're perfect, and he's handling it. If we admit that we're struggling with some stuff, then that Jesus isn't doing what he's supposed to be doing. You know what I mean? Whatever that lie that we buy into. And so my hope is that at least began a conversation in your heart and in your family and what it looks like. And so today, I'm going to answer some of your questions. And I put your questions before the counselors as well. And so they have had some input and insight into them. And my hope is that at the end of this is that it's not going to solve everything. It's not going to probably even put a Band-Aid on it. As a matter of fact, it may pull the Band-Aid off, and some things may be fresher than they have been for you, some of those wounds, but that you begin to understand that God, one of God's names and characteristics is he's the healer, Yahweh Rapha, and that hopefully that you'll lean into him and allow him to heal you through the different processes. And we'll talk more about that this morning. But one of the first questions that was asked was, how can I find a small win when life seems overwhelming? And so mental health is on spectrums, and so maybe you've been in that place where there's grief or depression or something that's significant, and you're just like, hey, I just need to find some win today, because all I really want to do is lay in bed and get out of bed. I don't want to shower. I want to just stream something, and you're just kind of in that mode. And I think some of us maybe had some of that and little snippets of that during COVID, because we didn't want to get out of bed because we were depressed. We didn't get to go to work for a few days, right? Y'all remember that? And so what does it feel like to get a small win? And so the first thing that you can do is pick one thing that you want to do that matters for tomorrow. And so pick that one thing, and that one thing could be, I'm going to take a shower. It could be as simple as that. Like, that's going to be the thing that I do tomorrow. Or it could be, hey, I went to the refrigerator yesterday, and I realized I really have nothing left besides ancient pickled okra that's outdated, and it looks fuzzy to begin with, and now it's got fuzz on the fuzz. And you're like, I'm going to have something. And we live in a rural town, and so we don't have Uber Eats and all that stuff. And so you're going to have to go to HEB. But now we have these cool things where you can order it online and show up. And so you're like, I can order. That's the thing I need for tomorrow. I need to order the HEB app so I can pull in. I don't have to really get fully dressed. I may just pull my, like I do, I pull my hair back so it looks like I've shampooed it, whatever you got to do. That's the one thing for tomorrow. So think about, what's that one thing that I can do tomorrow that's necessary for me? Put it on your calendar. I'm a calendar nerd. One of the great theologians in my life once said, you have time for what you make time for. And so if it's something of worth and value, you will schedule it. And so this is that one thing for tomorrow that's necessary. So put it on your calendar. I'll add an extra step. It may feel burdensome, depending on where you're at, is to actually tell someone you're going to do it. And so maybe you text a friend and say, hey, tomorrow my one thing is I'm going to go to HEB and pick up my groceries. And I've calendared it. I've already ordered. I know I'm picking it up at 4 p.m. I'm going to let you know that I'm doing it so you can check on me and make sure I've got my groceries. And then show up and do that one thing. Go to HEB, pick up your groceries, come home, and then hopefully in there you've got a Dr. Pepper Zero and you can celebrate, okay? That you can celebrate, hey, I set a goal for one thing. I did it. I accomplished it, and I'm here, and let's party with a Dr. Pepper Zero to celebrate. So that's one. Another question that was asked is, when you are going through a mental health struggle, should you shield your kids from it, or should you share what's going on? And I think this is obviously a real thing. Mommy and daddy are crying, or mommy and daddy are struggling, or kids in different seasons. And again, it depends on what age your kids are and where they're at in their development to have this discussion And again, as we know, if you have kids at different levels, they're more observant than we give them credit for. They're more wise than we think that they are. But so have an appropriate conversation with your kids, depending on their age. And so it may be just the using of feeling words or utilizing more specific terms like, hey, mommy or daddy is struggling with some anxiety or depression or whatever, and have those things. That not only does that help have that discussion with your kids, but it also shows a healthy person goes to counseling. And so it helps teach your kids that I go to a doctor for something that's broken. If my heart's broken, I'm going to go to the counselor. And so it reduces that stigma and burden. And we'll talk about what that looks like even in a small town. But it helps your kids even begin to put words. I know that several of the counselors have talked about this, that sometimes kids don't even have words to express what they're feeling. And so as a parent, whenever you have this conversation, you can give your children appropriate words, maybe even giving them emoji of, hey, I'm feeling this, and so this is why I'm going to the counselor, so we can talk about this deal. It helps them do that, because we all have mental health, emotional health is a normal part of life. It's just a matter of where we are on the spectrum in this season. We all have seasons of sadness. We all have seasons of joy. We have seasons of anger and frustration. And so all of that. And so it's a matter of us teaching our children in some ways that, hey, this is a normal part of life. Sometimes you need to go to someone that can help you walk through and think through some of this. And it also shows as a parent that we can be vulnerable about some things. Again, our kids catch on to a lot of things, but because we try to hide stuff from them, they don't even capture a great context for what we're actually thinking about and struggling with. But if we can tell them, hey, here's what we're dealing with, and allow them kind of in a little bit, again, appropriately, so they can see what you're dealing with, whether that's even your finances, some of that stuff, be able to talk with your kids. And it gives your kids that much more complete language for their own experiences. So when they come to you and say, hey, mommy, daddy, you remember when you were telling me that you felt like this and this was the emoji, they can then use that same language with you and help you care for them in a better way. And one of the counselors said, again, depending on age, is that maybe you have a book or you find a book and you read that book to your kids and you talk about what are the feelings that character is having in that book, or you can even role play. Be able to do that. And it deepens the bond between you and your child when you think about it. The next question that was asked is, we live in a world of AI. How many of y'all are tired of hearing about AI? Amen. I'm done. Like, I want to stick a fork in it and be done. Eat it for breakfast and get it over with. But it is what it is. It's here. We're dealing with it. We got to figure out how to use it. How to own it, not it own us. Like with any technology, there's it can be powerful tools for us, but it can also consume us and become a problem. And so the question is, what do we do with it? And the number one use right now for AI is companionship and therapy, which is concerning in and of itself. So then how do we respond to this as parents, as adults, but also how do we respond to this as a church? And so as we know, AI, because AI is not human, that won't be, can't be, never will be. At best, it mimics some particular characteristics of humanity. So therefore, it cannot be a counselor to you because it cannot express empathy. It does not have a soul. And so this is the thing that distinguishes us. This is some theology for you. The thing that distinguishes us from all creation is that you and I have a soul, because when God breathed his breath into Adam, he gave us the capacity. He gave us a soul. He gave us a capacity for a relationship with one another on a whole nother level, and most importantly, a relationship with him. And so AI does not have a soul. It doesn't have a capacity to do that. And so you and I have been made in the image of God. AI has been made in the image of man. And since creation, anything that we create is fallen and broken and incomplete. The only one that can create something that's completely perfect, without sin, without fault, is God. He made man. We chose something else beside him, but even God himself, when he came on earth, inhabited what people thought was evil, flesh, and he showed us that you can be 100% human. You could come up against temptation and not fail, but we mess up, don't we? Even this week, probably some of us messed up. And so AI falls short of meeting the demands for compassion and empathy. It's not able to be genuine. Even its care for us is not able to be even unconditional. And so it's not a good resource for therapy or for a healing process. And think about it this way too, is that AI is actually transactional. It's a transactional relationship at best. And so that we're always asking it questions and getting something from it. And unfortunately, sometimes that's our view in relationship with God too, is that we ask God for things and we never just sit and listen to God. And so transactional friendships should not be transactional. You shouldn't have friends so that what you can get from them. And then you have had people that you thought were your friends, but in reality, it was just so they could get something from you. You know what I'm talking about? And so that's what AI is that we use it for transactions to get something from it. But Jesus, if you think about it, God doesn't want us to be transactional with him. Jesus actually just wants us to be with him, to have a relationship with him. I think about it in this way that Becky and I have been married for a couple years now. And there are moments where we don't have anything to say to each other. And we have a drive. Like, we've gotten in the car, we said a few things, hey, da, 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 and we've talked about some stuff, and we're tired of talking about our kids, so we're not going to talk about them anymore. And so, then what do we have to talk about? And so, there's moments of silence. And the first few times that happened, I thought, do we just not like each other? Like, are we now both boring? We've reached 35, we're boring, we don't have a life, whatever. But part of it is just like, it's okay for us to be in each other's presence and to not fill the space with noise. And that it's okay for us to just be next to each other. I don't know. Your wife is going to get on you. Your wife is going to get on me. I'm sorry. Call the office for therapy. We'll make that happen. I'm not even going to look in your wet direction. that was good. Thank you. That's live streaming, so that's even better. But there are moments where we can literally, just even a short trip to Brenham, there may be this like 5 to 10 minutes and it's just silence. And so that's the moments where I don't really like silence for too long. And so sometimes I'll just kind of look over and I'm like, what are you thinking about? And she'll be thinking about something and it's totally random from what I'm thinking about because I just saw a sign for Weichel's and I'm thinking about kolaches. She's thinking about deep things, and I'm like, whoa, your spaghetti of your brain is working, mine's not. I've shut that box for this ride. But it's that power to be in presence, in silence, and to ask, what are you thinking? And I think that that's something that we're missing, not only in our relationship with each other, but most importantly in our relationship with God. And that if God is a transactional relationship for us, we're constantly trying to pull the lever and saying, God, I want this, I want this, I need this. And so we're constantly asking him for what we need and our burdens and stuff, which is obviously appropriate. But when's the last time we were just silent before him and just said, God, what are you thinking? God, what are you thinking? What's on your heart? God, what are you burdened for that I'm not seeing? God, what is it that you've been thinking about in my life that you want to talk to me about, but I've distracted myself with the busyness? I continue to ask because I don't want to sit in silence with you. What are you thinking, God? And that's the difference, I think, for us, is that we live in a world where most of our relationships, unfortunately, are transactional. And that it's what can we get out of each other, and we don't think about, I just want to be with some people because I want to be with them. There's something that clicks with us, and so we just enjoy being, and I don't need anything other than them, than their presence. And I think I see that because many of us don't have those 2 a.m. friends, and those are those 2 a.m. friends where we can do life with them, and we don't have to even say anything. We can just sit around a fire and just be in the presence of each other in a fire. And what does that look like to be in the presence of God in front of a fire and just say, hey, what are you thinking? And to just be still and to be silent and just to let him speak to the quiet places of your heart. I think about this too, as I told you this story, that Becky has trained our family that we were really good at, especially when the kids were younger. We could be in a store like Bass Pro or Super Target or something. And she would get distracted by looking at something and I'd be like, and so me and the kids would go and we'd go do fun things. We'd go to the toy section or go to whatever we were wanting to do. And Becky would turn around and we were gone. And she would immediately begin to go, psst, psst, psst. And it is amazing how with the way that she does it, all three of us could hear it all the way across Bass Pro Shop. She had trained us that well. And so we would actually be like, okay, I know where mom's at now. Let's keep moving so she can't find us, right? And that God sometimes is doing that to us. Is that we get distracted by other things. We move away from him because other things. And we think that we're hiding and he's pursuing us consistently going psst, psst. And we're running away. And that we use all kinds of things to do that. What is it like for us to just sit and to hear and to be trained to listen in the midst of all the chaos to hear his voice over the other things? And part of the times, part of the ways that we do that is because we hear him in the quiet when we just sit and listen too. So in the chaos, we can hear him because we've sat with him in the quiet. Because his voice will break through the noise that the world creates and the things that we use to medicate, and his voice, psst, breaks through all that noise because he's trained us in the silence. So that's part of it. Even Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11 through 14. If you've been around church for a little bit, you know Jeremiah 29, 11. I know some of you even have this as a tattoo, which I love it. It's awesome. My arms aren't long enough. But it says this, "For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord. They're plans for good and not for disaster, to give you a future and a hope." Now that sounds good. That sounds like a great tattoo, a bumper sticker, doesn't it? It's like God's for me. He's got this all stuff for me. But we don't read the verse 12, 13, and 14. And here's that verse in context. So I have plans for you, but in those days when you pray, I will listen. If you look wholeheartedly for me, you will find me. In other words, when you get to the end of seeking all the other things that you're seeking, I will be found. But you gotta come to me wholeheartedly, not half-heartedly, not like I'm gonna try this, but I'm gonna hold on to this. God's like, you've got to relinquish all these other things. I have plans for you, I have a purpose for you, I have a complete full life with everything that you can even imagine, even more than you can imagine. I have it for you, but you've got to come to me wholeheartedly, not half-heartedly. And you need to listen. But when you seek him, you will find him. Verse 14, I will be found by you if you seek me wholeheartedly. And the last part of this is beautiful. I will end your captivity and restore your fortunes. In other words, he caps it. Like, I have plans for you to prosper you, and I will remove you from captivity and fortunes, but you need to sit and pray, and you need to seek me wholeheartedly. If you don't do those things, then you're going to continue to find that... you're going to continue to be lost because you can't find and hear my voice amidst the chaos. The next question that was asked is, do you think writing poetry and songs and making music was King David's therapy? Did he have mental health issues? He was human, yes. He had mental health issues. If you read anything of David's story, he had heart and mental, emotional issues. He committed adultery. He murdered. He did it, everything. He had trauma in his life. One of his daughters had a tragic event, and the person that perpetrated that tragic event against the daughter was a son. He had a son that tried to take the crown from him, and so he had all of that stuff. And so part of his therapy was to write songs, was to cry out to God and say, God, why me? And God's like, you made the choices, and all the capacities and all the different things that were going on. And so actually some of the counselors spoke into this, and they said, hey, listen, Chris, what's interesting is what David did several thousand years ago, we're trying and learning that the things that David did actually do work in cognitive behavioral therapy. And so that they're teaching, they're calling it, they give it famous names so somebody can make money off of it. Trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, TFCBT. And it's where they're seeing promising results of people that are writing out, they're doing songs, they're making music, they're doing things in the depths of your soul so that they can have cognitive change in their mind so that it'll change the behavior. And so here David, as he's crying out to God, as he's writing songs, it's changing his mind. He's leaning into the truth that God loves him, that God is sovereign, and he's working that out so he can continue to live in those truths in that way. So then another question that was asked is, there's so many topics that we talked about, and so we would define the topic, right? Addiction, grief, depression. But what if you don't feel like you're in that extreme of those things, and but we maybe we're trending that way? And so the counselor said, hey, obviously all of us, there's a mental health spectrum that all of us are in different places and on with different things. And so sometimes we may be in a melancholy state, and then somebody else may be in deep grief or depression, but they were all in these states of all that. And that what we need to recognize is that when you get to a place that, like I talked about at the very beginning, that you're stuck in bed and you can't get out of it. so that you move from melancholy to a place of grief and depression where it interrupts your daily activities, then that's when you need to have people in your life that can speak truth to you. And this is where relationships matter, and this is where you see this scripturally, but also practically, is that you should have some core friends in your life. If you think of concentric circles, you should have some core friends in your life that know you, and that you know that they love you, and they don't judge you per se, and they're there with you, and you can sit around a campfire with them and do life with them and not say anything, because just their presence is good. And Jesus had those. Peter, James, and John were his friends. He could sit around a campfire with them and just be with them. He had his 12 that he invited in, and they were part of that core. And so what I wholeheartedly believe and have seen in my life is that there's core friends that you trust and have with, but then there's also those others that you can do things with and hang out with, but they're not your three per se. And then you have a little bit larger group. And so Jesus had a group of about 50 to 100 that he would gather, and they would have parties and all that. And then he had a bigger congregation. And I think that's normal, healthy relationships, that we have people that we know in the bigger crowd. Like even in here, like you're going, hey, I've seen you somewhere. And then you go to HCB and like, hey, did I see you at church? And so you've got that continuing thing. But then you have some 12 people that you can gather around a table, and y'all know each other at a pretty comfortable level, at least over some time. And then you have three people that like, listen, I'm gonna climb Kilimanjaro, and I want those three people with me, because it's gonna be an intense time. It's gonna be, and I need somebody like that with me. And this is what this is that you need people in your life that even in proximity can say to you, hey, I'm gonna tell you the truth in love. There's those three, four people that you can sit around a circle with, and I can be your best friend, but I cannot be your therapist. And so that you need some people that can tell you that in a loving way, and that you don't see it as judgment, but say, hey, you need to go a little bit further than a best friend. You need someone that can speak truth into your life, that has the education and skills and all that to be able to do that. Because there's going to be some things even a therapist needs to tell us that our best friend may not have the courage to do for fear of losing a friendship, because that's the human component. And so what does it look like? And so if somebody's schedule begins to get interrupted and you have some friends like that, speak in. But proximity of a relationship matters. This is why sometimes the church is considered hypocritical or judgmental, is because we speak into things, into people's life, and we don't have a relationship with them. And so we don't really know them. And so that it comes across judgmental, and it is, but it comes across judgmental, then comes across hateful instead of loving, because we don't have the proximity of relationship. And so that leads us into the next one, is what about this counselor-client relationship, especially in a small town? How can we remove the stigma and burden? And so I've had this question of like, Pastor Chris, like I'm really afraid that if I call the church and I get a counselor and I see that counselor and we have a couple of times, and all of a sudden I see it at HEB while I'm getting my post-toasties, and they're going to come up and go, hey, how's that addiction problem going? And I'm like, well, number one, that doesn't work that way. I was like, so let's forget that. Like, so they have an ethical code. They have an ethical standard. Just the same way that if you come to me and say, hey, I'm struggling with something, I'm not going to meet you back there by the cottage cheese and say, man, this cottage cheese kind of reminds me of your life. Kind of runny a little bit, lumpy. Nobody really wants it, but you got to eat it because it's healthy with your fruit. You know what I mean? Like, we're not going to have those conversations. And so an ethical relationship with a pastor or a counselor is kind of the same, is that in a small town that you may see the counselor, but when you go to HEB or Walmart or wherever you're at, they see you, they probably won't even, or they should not even acknowledge that they know you in any capacity, other than if you say hi to them and they'll say hi to you. And that's been true time and time again. And so they're not gonna dig into that. Part of it for us is to get past that, our own pride and our own ego of someone knowing us, truly knowing us, and looking at us and seeing us still as a human, as a person of God. And again, as we talk about here, no perfect people are allowed. That's us. And so that's, shouldn't, it's not going to shock anyone, but to be able to go in there. But part of the deal too is if you find a counselor, and as we give you counselors, and you call in and you say, hey, this is kind of what I'm struggling with or whatever, we'll say, okay, this person is best for you because they specialize in X, whether that's divorce, marriage counseling, addictions, trauma, all those different things. God gives everyone a passion and empathy for certain things, and so they move in to those things. And so they won't, so if they don't deal with substance abuse, they won't see you. They will put you off and give you to someone else that can help you in that capacity. The counselor-client relationship is different. And the counselors, we joked about it. It's in that moment of like, hey, listen, I'm your counselor. I'm not your friend. And so there's that line of like, here's someone that you can talk to and share some things with, but they're not your friend. So they're not, it's a little bit different because of the ethical code in that way. And so it is hard. It can be hard in a small town. And so we even here, we hide where the openings to the building are for counseling and where your car's at. And so people won't even know that you're here for counseling. So we try to work really hard to provide anonymity in that. Some books to think about, to read. One of them, we've talked about several different sessions. We talked about this one book called The Body Keeps the Score. It's a deeper book than normal, but it does talk about how you can feel grief, you can feel depression, you can feel some of these things coming on. And that's why I've come to this place where I believe that grief and depression in particular are much like a roller coaster, but also like an elevator that just drops without notice. And so there's times where you can feel it, like you can feel the clink, clink, clink of the ride, and you realize, hey, I'm entering. Whatever it is that's kind of triggered this, I'm kind of clinking up, and it's going to drop a little bit, and you don't know how far you're going to drop, so you can kind of sense that. And the other one sometimes is like an elevator that you've pushed the button, and you don't really know where it's going to go, and it's going to go down, and it's going to drop at some point. I've done a ride at Six Flags, and you go up to the top, and it sits there, and it clinks in, and you're just like, hanging out, and you think, okay, then you start to have a conversation with someone thinking you're going to be there for 30 minutes, and all of a sudden it just drops. And grief and depression does that. And part of that is because there's triggers for us. You never know. Like I told you, that every time I think of an Otter Pop, I think of my Meemaw. Every time I see Rolades, I think Rolades, I think of my Papa. And there's different things. So you may see a sign. You may have a smell. There may be something that triggers something. And grief will always be with us. This is the other part, is we don't get through or get over grief. We're always in some stage of grief because we've lost something or someone of worth and value. So it's always missing. And so you may lose a spouse, you may lose a child, you may lose a friend, you may lose a parent. And so they're always gone. And so they won't be around the table again. So there will be moments where you're reminded of the greatness of the loss and what they meant to you. And so that's always there. But the proximity from the event, hopefully over time, doesn't lessen the pain, but you're able to understand it and begin to move further into it and move into what a new normal is. Grief is never to be gotten through, but it's to be walked in and to see where God's going to take us on the other side. Another book is The Anxious Generation. If you're a parent of any kid under the age of zero, you need to read it. It deals particularly with how cell phones, smartphones, all that stuff, internet has created anxiety among our kids and ourselves as well. Another one is Beautiful People Don't Just Happen by Scott Sauls. It's a great book. Quick read. Soul Repair, talking about how we are, as we believe as Christians, that our soul is a part of this whole thing, and what does it look like for your soul to be repaired through the mental health process. Depression, my favorite book on depression. I don't know how those two things go together, but my favorite book on depression is by Edward Welch, and it's called Looking Up, Depression, Looking Up from the Stubborn Darkness. It's a pretty thick book. And then if you're not into thick books, or tough books, one by a good pastor, old pastor, Charles Swindoll, wrote a book a few years ago called Getting Through the Tough Stuff, and he leans into that. And so those are some books. If you didn't get those, email me, and I'll send you an Amazon link through me so I can make some money off of you. No, I'm kidding. I don't do that yet, but that's a good idea. I may start doing that. So here's the deal. We come into the world as babies screaming. Even the mom in that moment is screaming. It's pain and joy all mixed together in that moment. I mean, even that's part of the curse, is that pain. Childbearing is painful, but then I don't know how long it is, if it's an hour or if it's days, and moms forget the pain of the childbirth and say, I want to have another one. That feels weird, but how can there be joy in the pain? But there's, from birth to our final breath, our constant companion is pain and suffering. And so our tendency is, in our humanness, is that we desire to abolish it. And when we can't abolish it, we begin to medicate it, or we do things. And so, but I want you to think about this idea that pain can actually have benefits for us. Physically, You know, we go to the gym and we force pain upon ourselves, and in that pain, you hope that you get another muscle fiber or you have a little bit less fat. You're doing things, you're putting yourself through a painful process because you want to grow, right? I remember even there was the seasons in both of my kids' lives where they would wake up screaming in the middle of the night and there were joints or something were hurting, and it was that the doctors are like, that's growing pains. Like literally it's that thing happening. And so it's hard to tell your child, hey, listen, I know it hurts, but now look at dad, you're going to be 6'5". I mean, it's going to be awesome to have that. And but pain also allows us to go to the doctor and pinpoint the problem. Like a child can tell their mom, hey, it hurts in my tummy or it hurts in my shoulder, and you can begin to pinpoint. And because we can pinpoint pain, we can provide a solution to it. And same with mom and doctor. There's also a personal pain, and the personal pain can lead to obedience. And so in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 8, it says, even though Jesus was God's son, he learned obedience from the things he suffered. And so if Jesus had to learn obedience through suffering, how much better do you and I think that we shouldn't have to learn obedience through some of the suffering? If you believe that God is sovereign and God's control and God, everything that happens in your life, God allows it, then some of those things he has allowed so that there can be suffering, so there can be refining, so that we can be more obedient to him. As a parent, we do that. We do things. We provide pain for our children so they can become more obedient. Whenever we realize that they're about to stick their finger in the socket, you pop them on the pamper and say, no, you want to cause a little pain here so they don't have pain here, because you know that at some point there's going to be bigger sockets that kids are going to be tempted to stick their fingers into, and it's going to have much more serious consequences. And so we provide pain for our children personally so that they don't have the bigger pains. And God does that for us as well. He allows us to suffer and experience some pain for better obedience. Another way that we experience pain is spiritually. James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4 says this, dear brothers and sisters, when troubles of any kind come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. Again, that's that birthing, like, why would I count suffering and stuff as a great joy? And because you know that when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So let it grow. For when your endurance is fully developed, you'll be perfect, complete, and needing nothing. Think about this. The Hebrews had a moment where they could have gone into the promised land, but they messed up and they didn't get to, so they walked around for 40 years. And for 40 years, even though they disobeyed God, for 40 years, when they're walking in the desert, God never deserted them in the desert. By day, he provided a cloud. By night, he provided fire. And so even though they were walking through what's been termed the dark night of the soul, where there wasn't in the desert, there wasn't anything necessarily that there was a mark of disobedience, that God was still present with them and he was close by, but it felt like he was far away. And that was their grumbling of God, when are you gonna? And that we have those moments too where, hey, listen, we feel like we're walking in the desert, but God hasn't deserted us, but we're like, God, when are you gonna? And the desert time is that he's preparing us and perfecting us so that he can take us in to the promised land, because they weren't ready for it before. And so what does God need to do in us and grow in us so that we can be made perfect, complete, and enter into the next phase of our spiritual journey with him? And so sometimes there is a dark night of the soul where you're walking in obedience, but it doesn't feel like he's there. And so one of the things too that I think about is that one of the reasons we feel like he's far away is because we're so distracted. We have so many things that distract us. And again, what is it like to be silent before God? And then also this mental, emotional pain, which isn't sometimes as clear, like what's happening and why it is. And C.S. Lewis penned a great thing. He says this, mental pain is less dramatic than physical pain, but it's more common and also more hard to bear. It is easier to say my tooth is aching than to say my heart is broken. But sometimes, however, because it is broken and because it continues, it persists and the effect is devastating. When I think about that, I think about the mental, emotional struggle. I think about Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane in Matthew chapter 26. When Jesus brought his three 2 a.m. friends with them, and he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. And when we naturally, when we think of the Garden of Gethsemane, we think of this peaceful place. It's a piece of rest. It's a place of good thing. I mean, people go to pray. They go hang out. They pick olives. And so we have this image of it. But Gethsemane literally means oil press. And so Jesus is being pressed out. He's at a place of suffering and anguish, and he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, the oil press, because he's being pressed out. And so in verse 38, it says, he told them, James and John and Peter, my soul is crushed. I'm being pressed out with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. And these are those core friends that we need in our life that can go to the places with us, the gardens that maybe in the past have been places of peace, but they're places where our soul is being pressed out with the oil. And we don't know what to do other than to pray and to ask and have people around us. What does it look like to be one of those friends? In the oil press, the first pressing, the oil back in those days, the olive when it was pressed out, the first pressing was an offering to God, so it would be used in the temple and temple alone. The second pressing was a daily need. The third pressing was candles at home. Everything about each pressing, they tried to get everything they could possibly do, and they used it to the point that it was completely done and used up, and every pressing provided something. And so for you and I, when we go through these moments of pressing and suffering, that God is using it for his good and for his glory, whether it's holy, whether it's mundane, he's using it in our life. In verse 39, he says he went down a little bit further and he bowed his face to the ground and he said, Father, if it is possible, let this cup of suffering be taken away from me. Jesus' pain was so intense that he pleaded with God for a way out. Have we not all been there? God, if there's any other way than to go through this pressing, God, if there's any other way than to walk in this desert, if there's any other way than this, and he reminded, even for Jesus, hey, listen, some things are overwhelming, but I am with you even in this moment. So let me close with this. One of my favorite verses is 1 Peter 5:7. Give all your worries and cares to God, for he cares for you. And I think that's what we need to be reminded of, is that God cares for each one of us. And that if we know that truth and believe that truth and we can live in that truth, then we can give our cares and our worries over to him, and then we can just be silent and just say, God, I don't understand, I don't know why, but I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to listen and I'm going to allow you to speak to the dark places of my soul, because I know you care for me. I know you want to heal my broken heart and to restore me and to make me whole. Let's pray together. Dear Holy Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for the chance to think about these things. Father, may you bring grace where we need grace. May you bring mercy where we need mercy. Father, if we're in the midst of being pressed out by the suffering and pain, may be reminded that you yourself went through that in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's in your Son's name that we pray. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for the Crosspoint Community Church podcast. It is our prayer that this message was encouraging to you as you follow Jesus. For more about Crosspoint Community Church, you can find us online at crosspointchurchtx.org. Have a great week.